Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. There's something eerie going on in Terence Greene's novel, Shadow of Ashland. The protagonist, Leo Nolan, is in Ashland, Kentucky. He's arrived in search of his Uncle Jack, who's been missing for 50 years. Old letters from Jack, dated 1934, had suddenly started arriving in Toronto at Leo's father's place. Jack's last known address was the Scott Hotel in Ashland. Now here's the eerie part. Leo strikes up a conversation on the street with a young man who, it turns out, is his Uncle Jack. Without warning or explanation, Leo is back in 1934, sharing a room with Jack at the Scott Hotel. Late one night, Leo wakes up to the sound of voices and banging coming from the basement.
It hadn't occurred to me that my concept of a basement was formed by my experience as a Canadian 50 years hence, an area carved out neatly and fashioned to harbor the mechanics of a house, furnace, electricity, plumbing, storage, and then you could opt for finishing it, adding an entire living level. I reached the bottom of the stairs below the main floor and found myself standing in mud. No furnace. Nothing but light bulbs dangling intermittently from an electric wire that dwindled away into the darkness. I could smell the earth around me, damp and primitive. Focusing my eyes, I looked about and saw a large room that was the size of what a full basement might be. A cave beneath the Scott Hotel filled with enormous piles of moist brown subsoil. And I could hear men digging. The string of light bulbs led to the far side of the room, toward the sounds that echoed feebly all the way to the third floor. Shading my eyes from the glare with my hand, I stepped carefully, slowly through the mud and earth, following the lights to the far end of the room, and stared in silence at the tunnel that had been dug in the wall in front of me, at the lights snaking out into the subterranean channel beneath the streets of Ashland. 2x4s and 2x6s blocked off an opening 6 feet in height by 4 feet in width. Tram tracks disappeared down the center of the tunnel. I stepped onto the ties and entered the tunnel, walking slowly, carefully. I seemed to be heading east out under the street. About 20 feet into the tunnel, the noises of men working became clearer, closer. It all hit me with a brazen clarity, like the tumblers of a giant lock sliding open. "Bank's a bank," he had said, "but that one's still there." I stood for several minutes watching them dig before anyone noticed me. The two men that I had seen entering the hotel earlier, Stanley, two others whom I did not know, and Jack. The air was scarcely breathable, close, humid, fetid. The men were naked to the waist, crowded together in the confines of the tunnel, covered in sweat and dirt, ankle deep in mud. Slowly, one by one, they straightened, stopped what they were doing, stared at me, brows wrinkled, mouths set. The two strangers at the far dirt face leaned on their shovels. Stanley let his pickaxe settle at his feet. Finally, Jack turned and met my gaze. He rested one hand on the small tram filled with freshly dug earth. Even in the harsh dimness of a single light bulb, his body streaked with grime, surrounded by puddles, mud, crowbars, I saw his blue eyes flash recklessly. They waited in silence. Their glances flickered to the empty spaces behind me, to where the tunnel dwindled into a string of harsh light bulb pearls. Jack spoke first. "This here's Leo." They still waited, listened. I answered their unspoken question. "I thought I heard something. I came to see." "What do you see?" asked Stanley, his voice soft. I looked at them. I looked from one to the next, each in turn, mud-stained and still as stop clocks. "Dreams," I said. Then I breathed slowly in and out, my heart beating like a bird's wings. "I see dreams." "He might not be alone," one of the strangers spoke. They squinted around me, listened. "You alone, Leo?" asked Jack. I nodded. "Yes." "He ain't from around here. He talks funny," the man continued. "He talks funny like me," Jack said. I'm a friend of Jack's sister, I said. Jack smiled. I watched them. I listened to the silence below the earth. I listened to my heart. I can help, I said. Jack nodded. The white teeth showed as the smile broadened, and I saw my mother's face. The rapids thundered in my veins. I want to help. We stood in the mud in the basement under the Scott Hotel. They seemed satisfied that I was alone. This here's Emmett and Henry. Stanley introduced me to the two men who had passed me on the front veranda the previous afternoon. They were sturdy, strong men in their early 30s, I guessed, whose hands I could see bore the calluses of hard work. And George and Jimmy. George was round-faced and perhaps the oldest of the group, maybe 40. Jimmy's red hair was matted and filthy. Irish, I thought. George looked at Stanley. I know about this. Stanley's eyes crinkled. He looked at Jack, then back at me. Don't want to make a mistake, said Jimmy. His feet shifted uneasily. What are our choices? Stan asked. They were silent. I'll vouch for him. They all turned to stare at Jack. He's just a guy. He knows my sister back home. The others listened to him. He's okay, he said. And then the smile came back in full bloom. I can just tell. Oh, he could be a cop, a fed, Pinkerton, George said. Jack smiled. Nah, he said. Any guy could find me the way he did, with nothing but scraps of letters and old photographs. It's kind of like he's meant to be here with us. Stanley looked at Jack. Hope you're right, he said at last. Jack nodded. I am. You know what's going on? Stanley asked. I nodded. Jobs dried up and blew away, I said. They listened. 2 million men roaming the country looking for jobs, handouts. Maybe 3 million, maybe more. More than 20 million unemployed. Jimmy nodded. And out there, right in the middle of it all, sits that big bank, fat with money. They stared at me. And here you are, fellows who know a thing or two about digging tunnels, about going into the earth for what's there. I stared hard at Stanley Matusik. Who'll be hurt? Anybody in town? Neighbors? No, he said. We ain't gonna drill safety deposit boxes. Nothing personal like that, just cash. All insured. Nobody'll be hurt. I nodded. It was madness. All of it. The idea, the tunnel, the Scott Hotel, my presence here, all of it. I'm in, I said. Stanley smiled. Jack looked at me in wonder. Money'll come in Friday, the 12th. Bank'll be full all weekend. Leaves on Monday. It's the same every month. We seen it, like clockwork, Stanley said. I'm not following. Comes in by train, he explained patiently. From Huntington, Charleston, Bluefield, Roanoke, stays the weekend, goes on down to Louisville, ends up in Cincinnati in a big goddamn bank, bigger than this one. How much? Stanley shrugged. Depends. We got folks tell us some months it gets as high as 400,000. Others, bad months, 250, maybe 3. Whose money is it? Jack smiled. He looked at Stanley. Barbara's, Stanley said. I know my lips parted because I found myself closing them quickly. Barbara Hutton, Woolworth Heirs. I pictured Jean, then Teresa, behind the counter. Newspapers say she inherited $45 million, George said. I heard 65, said Emmett. I looked at Jack. She won't miss it, he said. I looked into the tunnel. It went in 60, 80, 100 feet. I couldn't tell. How close are you? We'll be there by the 14th, said Stanley. He stepped in front of me. We could use another strong back, just to be sure. This is crazy, I said. You'll never do it. It's too much digging, too far. My daddy was part of a crew cut a tunnel 10 miles long one way, then 23 miles t'other, said Stanley. Had to get around a ridge. He traveled about 5 miles a day on his knees. I studied the firm set of their faces again. Crazy, I thought, completely exhilarated. The next morning, Stanley, Jack, and I sipped coffee on the veranda of the Scott Hotel. It was only 8 o'clock, but the sun was already warming. You know much about Barbara? Stanley asked. Some, not much, I said. She got the inheritance last November, about a year ago. You read about her coming out party? Asked Jack. Don't remember, I said. When she was 18, he thought for a moment, would be 1930, was in all the papers and the magazines. I shrugged, smiled. Was at the Ritz-Carlton in New York. 1,000 guests. Marie Chevalier, Rudy Valley, 3 other orchestras. For her, there weren't no prohibition or depression, said Stanley. Was thousands a bottle of champagne, the paper said. I began to realize the degree of people's obsession with her. had flowers and trees flowing in special from both coasts. Eucalyptus trees from California, said Jack. I had read once how farmers there during the Depression planted mile-long windbreaks of eucalyptus to keep the plowed topsoil from blowing away. One night only, said Stanley, emphasizing the point with his index finger. Party for a little girl. Cost $50,000. He paused. All we wanted was union wages. Nobody'll be hurt, said Jack, his blue eyes sparkling, a missionary zeal spreading across his face. And he smiled that smile. Drop in the bucket, he said. Only problem we might run into is rain, said Stanley. I looked at him, listened. Rain in tunnels, they don't mix. Yet a lot of it could weaken the ground. Too much of it could flood. He sipped his coffee, thought for a minute. Been lots of flooding in this town. People in Ashland still talk about the big one of 1913. He nodded toward the north. River rose up, whole town went underwater 2-3 feet. We all looked into the east, looked at the sky. Later that evening, I dug with them, in the mud beneath the streets of Ashland. The shovel in my hand was real, but the sensation of being beneath the earth, buried treasure and Rosetta Stone lying in wait somewhere ahead of us, was not. My little girl Jenny, she got typhoid last year, said Henry. All her hair fell out. She just turned 8 years old this summer. Went through the school year bald-headed. He wheezed a load of dirt to one side. Couldn't afford no wig for her. Leastways, no wig worth wearing. She got used to it, he said. We all did. The earth below Ashland was soft and wet. The tunnel cut through occasional springs which ran into puddles that needed to be channeled back into a pit in the basement of the hotel. The pit was only a few feet deeper than the basement floor, and the sound of water running into it, into the pool at the bottom, was something that became constant. If one dug too low, Henry told me, one would inevitably meet the Ohio River. It was always there, he said, just beneath us. I slept until noon. When I woke, the stiffness of the muscles in my back, arms, legs, all told me what I already knew, that I had done more than I should have. Jack was gone. Gazing at the window ledge above me, I touched the wall beside me where I lay on the floor. Solid. Real. I wandered down to the Woolworths on Winchester. Candy, postcards, toys, bars of soap, chewing gum, gold-filled rings that a baby could wear sold for a dime. At the food counter, I saw Jack sitting, talking to Teresa. I was several aisles away, unnoticed. I watched him touch her hand. I watched her let him leave his hand there. I watched her smile, saw the way she looked at him. I left before they saw me. I had seen what I suspected that first time I had seen them together. I had seen another of Jack Rady's secrets. In the late afternoon, I was sitting on the veranda steps of the hotel when Jack came strolling down the street. He smiled and sat down beside me. We sat in silence for a few minutes, letting our Canadian skin feel the Kentucky sunshine coming through the October clouds. "You really go to work at the hospital?" I asked finally. He nodded. I go there, do my job. When the job's done, I leave. Do it as quickly as I can. Come back here. Then do my real work. He leaned forward, placed his elbows on his knees. Then he looked at me. Tell me about Marg, he said. How's she doing? It's 1934, I thought. She'd be 25 years old. My sister Anne would be 4. Ron was 2. Doing well, I said. Kids keep her busy. I thought for a moment. She's good at what she does, being a mother, loving her family. He nodded. Marg got married fast, he said. Sometimes things happen fast. He thought about it. Then, how's Tommy? Works hard, works for the Globe. Gets up when it's still dark. He's in charge of all the boxes all the way up Young Street, past the city limits. I had heard the story many times. Marg must be alone a lot. He looked at me strangely, inquisitive. I thought of Jack and Teresa. It's not like that, I said. He smiled, a bit embarrassed but relieved. You should keep writing to Marg. She loves your letters, saves them, he frowned. Keep writing. I will, he said. The frown deepened. I definitely will. At 5 that day, along with dozens of others, we had white beans boiled in water, 2 slices of bread and a cup of tea. At 1 a.m., Jack came into the room. I sat up in his bed where I'd been sleeping while he was at the hospital. When he flicked on the light, I saw it on him at the same time I heard it through the open window. His hair was plastered wet to his head and the drips had formed in his chin. The shoulders of his shirt were soaked through. It was a steady downpour. Jack looked out the window. "Need to talk to Stan," he said. "He knows the feel of this better than I do." I put on my shoes. Jack went through the door. I followed him, closing it after me. They were in the basement, gathered about the drain hole there. Stanley, Emmett, Henry, George, Jimmy. Stan looked up when he heard us coming. They stepped aside as Jack and I glanced down into the hole. It had risen about 6 inches. When I looked up, George met my eyes. "The Ohio," he said, "lying, waiting." We listened to the steady trickle of water into the pit, heavier now than I had heard it before. "What do we do?" asked Jack. Stanley looked at him, shrugged. "Keep digging." "Pray," said Jimmy. He ran a dirty hand through his matted red hair.
Michael Hogan, reading from Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. Tomorrow, the rain won't stop and the water in the tunnel keeps rising. Where weather is concerned, there's nothing as dramatic as the peal of thunder and the crack of lightning and the torrential downpour that's unleashed. I have poetic accounts of a big storm from two poets and two different centuries. First up is A Thunderstorm by the Confederation poet Archibald Lampman. It's read by Gordon Pinsent.
A Thunderstorm. A moment, the wild swallows, like a flight of withered gust-caught leaves serenely high, toss in the wind-rack up the muttering sky. The leaves hang still. Above the weird twilight, the hurrying centers of the storm unite, and spreading with huge trunk and rolling fringe, each wheeled upon its own tremendous hinge, tower darkening on. And now, from heaven's height, with the long roar of elm trees swept and swayed, and pelted waters on the vanished plain, plunges the blast. Behind the wild white flash that splits abroad the pealing thunder crash, over bleared fields and gardens disarrayed, column on column comes the drenching rain.
Gordon Pinsent, reading Archibald Lampman's poem, A Thunderstorm. Our second poem is a vivid description of another bout of nature's sound and fury. In the Path of a Storm was written by the late New Brunswick poet, Dorothy Roberts, and it's read by Sherry Flett.
In the Path of the Storm. I passed into a different world when the lights went out. One groping and small, circled with candlelight, everything seen in duplicate, nothing without its powerful shadow self stretching the dark in overhead and along the walls of my heart. The candle flame limits the scope of what can be done. A small world carried around with the action. Up against it, the wind wallows in the loud treetops. A gust passes through, carrying a broken rain cloud. One roar over and the rain down in torrents and a comet-like cohesion in the universe.
In the Path of the Storm, a poem written by the late Dorothy Roberts and read by Sherry Flett. It's from Roberts' book of selected poetry, The Self of Loss, published by Fiddlehead Books. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, and after that, it's classical music from CBC Winnipeg on Northern Lights.